Well, hey, I'm Josh. Hey, everybody. Thanks for riding your scooters down here to hang out with me today. A lot of scooters out there. Well, all right. You all look very nice today. Thanks again for coming out. What I'm here to talk about at sort of a high level today is how do you work with a new design material? And how do you approach the texture of a new technology? And how do you work with the grain of that material in a way that adapts to its strengths and weaknesses, and ultimately lets you shape it into a product that meets meaningful user needs? Because I think we all have become increasingly familiar with what it looks like when we don't do that. And so, friends, I just want to take a little time travel back just a year ago to visit our old friend Juicero. And some of you remember Juicero, the internet-connected juicer, retailed for $700 before they tweaked it a little down to $400. The Juicero's amazing innovation here, though, is that it actually did not juice fruit or vegetables, right? It squeezed these processed juice packets. Except it turned out you didn't actually need the fancy juicer to squeeze the packets. You could just do it by hand. And so by the end, it was just sort of like a one-to-one thing. At the end of 2 minutes, you had two identical glasses. Either way, just drinking the stuff out of the packets, right? So technology hard at work. It wasn't a totally useless thing, though. They did sort of apply this technology that the machine could read the barcode printed on each juice pack to check whether the contents had expired, right? To check the expiration date. Should be noted, the expiration date was also printed on the back of the packet. So what we had at the end of this, right, was an expensive kitchen gadget that solved no problems and did no work, right? And I want to say this is actually not a new thing. There's a long history of bullshit kitchen gadgets, right? The juicer designed by Philippe Starck and just makes a mess if you try to use it, right? It looks nice. Try to use it to juice a lemon, forget it, but it's okay. Because Philippe tells us that he never designed it to juice lemons. He designed it to start conversations. Yeah, that explains it. Friends, that's some bullshit. That's some bullshit right there. I'm going to go ahead and say it. This is self-serving, right? This is something that serves the ego of the designer, or so many times in our own cases, of the technologist, when I believe that our job is to serve others, right? So in the enthusiasm of the making of the thing, of the embrace of the new technology or the new design material, we often wind up putting that effort into the thing instead of into the service of what the thing might do. And again, you know, kitchens, for whatever reason, full of examples like this. I know you've all been waiting for your Wi-Fi-enabled kettle. A Brit named Mark Rittman owns one of these, and he set about trying to make a cup of tea. But the kettle encountered just a little bit of network trouble. It turns out that it couldn't connect, right? And so the kettle asked as kindly as possible to be recalibrated. So 3 hours later, the thing had sabotaged his Wi-Fi router. The kettle had slipped into some unknown nether region of his home network. To his credit, Mark is undefeated here. So he starts port scanning the network in search of his kettle. And 10 hours later, he gets the kettle back up and running, but then his smart lights had cut out because they needed a firmware upgrade. So he's, you know, faithfully cataloging his effort here as he goes. And the internet was not exactly sympathetic, right? Sort of not everyone was thinking, you know, this is not quite the life that I'm looking for here. I apologize for the language, friends. I'm just reporting the facts. Just reporting the facts. Fast Company used these words to review yet another kitchen gadget, and it doesn't even really matter which one it is, because I think that these descriptions feel familiar to all of us, both in terms of the products that we wind up creating, but even more meaningfully, perhaps, as consumers. That with the best of intentions, we just wind up disappointing with distracting or mediocre or just error-prone products. Because we're trying to use these new technologies or these new design materials in ways that kind of undermine their fragile state. They're new. And sometimes it's the newness themselves make it fragile, or our own misunderstanding of the technology breaks that design material. So what I want to talk about today is how do we use technology in a way that it wants to be used, in a way that adds meaning, and I think even more powerfully, that amplifies human potential, which I think, especially when we talk about machine learning and AI, this is a real point of, it's an open question of, is the technology going to do that to make us more of who we are, to focus and amplify our judgment and our capability, or is it going to replace us? And I think that there are, it could cut either way, and it's up to the people in this room, so I want to share some ideas around that. These kinds of questions, I think, are especially important when we enter a new chapter of technology, and I believe that's one of those times. It's an exciting time because we are working in digital design at a moment when we have the arrival of a new design material, machine learning and artificial intelligence. I run a design studio called Big Medium in New York City, and we focus on design for what's next. So I help my client companies understand how to embrace new technologies and create products that are themselves meaningful and used in the right way. And for the last decade, I would say that that effort has focused on designing for mobile. How do we push the frontiers of mobile and use its sensors, combined often with machine learning and image processing and all those sort of possibilities to create new products? But over the last couple of years, that focus has shifted a little bit. And I found that more and more people are interested in exploring not just mobile, but machine learning, machine-generated content, machine-generated interfaces, and even machine-generated interactions. So my strong sense is that the last decade was defined, in terms of digital products, by mobile. And the next decade is already being designed or being defined by machine learning and artificial intelligence. But for a lot of designers, it's not quite clear yet how do we engage with that. That it's something that has, frankly, been run with great effect in many cases by engineers and data scientists. They've shown us what's possible, but design has sort of been off a little bit to the side. I think that that designers have a really urgent role to play here, and that machine learning, as I say here, can be a design material. Just like HTML and CSS are design materials, just like language and prose are design materials, just like dense data display is a design material. And like any design material, it's important to understand its texture, not only how it can be used, but how it wants to be used and how it should be used. So whenever you work with a new design material and approach a new technology, these are the kinds of questions that you want to ask. And I would argue that these are great questions to ask for any new technology because they ask us, what does the technology offer us? But also they begin to explore, what does it require of us? What do we have to pay in return for its use? All right, so these are the questions that I want to investigate. I'm going to spend most of the time on the first two. How do we think about, as designers, putting machine learning to work? And then also understanding, what are the special qualities or textures of this design material, the grain of the material? And what does that mean about how we need to approach it and the technique that we might bring to bear? And finally, sort of end there. Does that sound okay? You guys doing all right? You look great. You do. You look great. All right. All right. Well, let's start with the first one. What can it do? Or you know, another way to put this is, why would you team up with machine learning? How do you put this to work in your own products and in your own practice? I think broadly, the opportunity that machine learning affords us is that we could detect patterns in anything. How might we act on them? What would we do with that? And so I want to explore that in this section by looking at the sort of the five broad applications for machine learning, the ways to think about it, and then the four questions that it can answer in your product or in your organization or in your particular mission. So what I'm going to do is I'll start with those five applications. And I think of it in terms of this way: recommendation, prediction, classification, clustering, and generation. I'm going to step through each of these and give you a few just sort of quick examples, just to sort of find our way and our bearings in this. The first one is, let's look to Slack for an example of recommendation. Slack, about a year ago, launched this feature for big teams that helps you find people in your organization who talk about certain topics. So this is machine learning that helps you find experts in your organization. So here, if you need an expert in hiring process, Isabella is your go-to. And so this is recommendation. It's really familiar and perhaps maybe the simplest in some way to understand aspect of machine learning. here's a bunch of sort of ranked documents that match a specific context or concept. It's just sort of smart search results, right? This is closely related to classification, which I'll discuss in a bit, but also to prediction. So let me just take a quick look at that. Predictive keyboards are an example of that, right? So they take the statistically most likely next word and have that show up above the keyboard. So it's taking all the past data and sort of saying, based on what we've just seen, this is statistically the next most likely thing to see, say, or these sorts of examples. And this is sort of a nice, simple little intervention to speed the error-prone task of touchscreen typing. So based on historical data, here are the things that are most likely to happen next. That's prediction. Classification. Google Forms, which is likely familiar to many of you, gives us an example of that. When you add your questions for a Google Forms survey, you choose the format of the answer that you want. So here's that menu open, and there's, I don't know, what, 12, 13, something like that, options. It's a manageable amount, but you still have to think about it, scan through it, figure out which one fits the one that you, the format of the answer that you want best. So the default is multiple choice with radio buttons, but there are a lot of options here, and they've made it as simple as they could, but it takes some time and thought to figure it out, right? But look what happens when you start typing the question text and how that changes the answer format. How satisfied are you? If you start typing that, maps it to a linear scale. It gives you a new default. So they added a little machine learning to the mix to look at your question and classify it to a specific answer type. Which of the following apply? Maps to checkboxes. So it's just a convenient little bit of intelligence to make the process easier. Right? And again, it's classification. So it's like humans have gone through a whole bunch of different questions and mapped them to this type of answer. So the very sort of human-defined set of classifications, training the machines to match different questions to different classifications. So one thing I want to say about this is that these examples that I've shown you are pretty kind of almost dull, right? I mean, sort of every day. It's like, this is not the fancy robot overlord that I expected. You know, this is not the artificial intelligence of sentient machines that I sort of knew and understood. And I guess this is one thing that I really want to point out right now that I think is really important for designers of just everyday interfaces to understand is that we can put machine learning into those now, that we can get cozy with these casual uses of machine learning, of almost these mundane examples. You know, I mentioned before that I think of this as being similar to the next shift that we need to accommodate as designers as mobile was the last shift. So I think we need to get as comfortable designing for the algorithm as we've become designing for the small screen, or as we are using JavaScript in a web page. In the same way you might just sprinkle a little JavaScript over an otherwise static design to give it some interaction. Machine learning is accessible and democratized enough that you can have access to those tools, your organization can, to have and afford even this kind of casual intervention of machine learning to elevate the experience just a little bit, to get some of the noise out of the way for our users and our customers. So you can quote me on that, friends. Just sprinkle a little machine learning on it. That's what I'm talking about. It doesn't have to be a big deal. Your product doesn't have to be a big, fancy, artificial intelligence something-something to make it go. It's not magic. It's not beyond the means of your company or of you. And I'll describe some services later that you can use right now to get into this. But my point is that in many cases right now, machine learning is best and most predictably deployed for small interventions to solve critical tasks in any given activity. And I think there are bigger opportunities, too, where the machines can discover new insights. And that brings us to the fourth application that I wanted to mention, or clustering. Clustering can feel like either magic or nonsense, depending on the success of the algorithm. With classification, I mentioned before, that was sort of human-supervised, right? Humans say, here are the classifications, we're going to train the machines to recognize how to bucket into those. With clustering, that's completely unsupervised. The machines just go out and they find patterns. So it sort of effectively says, these things over here are different from the average in these common ways. That's a cluster. And then over here, this other group, that's different from average in these other ways. There's another cluster. So it's classification, but done by machine logic, not human logic. And that means that it can see things that we otherwise couldn't or wouldn't, both because of the scale it can use, but also because machines sometimes find or see patterns that we're just not tuned into. So it's a way to identify things that depart from normal or the average. So it's often used to identify, for example, fraud or crime, disease, spending outside the norm. Interesting sort of departures or sort of clusters of things that can group data points in interesting ways. That also means that you can use it to identify clusters of products or customers or people by behaviors or associations that might not be immediately apparent or obvious. Right? So I think one of the interesting things, too, is you sort of go off and you let the machines discover interesting clusters and then let them generate stuff. I'm going to sort of show you a couple of examples of generation, where generation is basically means make something. It could mean draw something. It could mean build a photo or a video. It could mean write a screenplay, or even sort of like just sort of smaller little haiku, for example. So Douglas Summers Stay is a researcher who's interested in artificial creativity, and he created a wordplay generator. So, for example, if you give the system a word or idea, like rocking chair, then it comes up with a two-word rhyming description, like knitter sitter. Right? Or you give it Star Wars, and you get droid overjoyed. Right? So it's a system that's based on semantic vectors. It organizes words that have strong associations. So here it finds those words and then runs them through a separate algorithm to find the pairs that rhyme. And what you get is sort of something that, this seems awfully clever, right? It's something that borders on some notion of creativity, but it's, of course, just sort of with enough data and enough rules, it can start to come up with things that are interesting. So that's sort of a fun example, and we'll look at more powerful clustering examples later. But just wanted to give you a sense of, here are the five applications, sort of ways to think about how do you bring this into products that you might be working on today. Sort of bring this home, though, I want to sort of point out what these abilities look like when you aim them, for example, at products that are aimed at us as designers, just to sort of give a sense of both the power and maybe sometimes the unsettling implications of it. You probably recall Google Quick Draw from a couple years ago, a Google experiment to identify sketches. And the way that it would work is that you go in and it will prompt you to draw a mountain, for example, and you start drawing it, and it will sort of quickly identify, hey, it's a mountain. Pretty good, right? It's pretty quick. So draw a calculator. And I start drawing, and it starts guessing. It's like, I see a square, a triangle, an elbow, a dishwasher, a calculator. Right? It's great. Just keep on cranking. Here's prompting me for a hamburger. It's a shoe. It's a hot dog. It's a hot tub. It's bread. It's a hamburger. And pretty good. All right. And then finally, I'll give you one more example. Flip-flops. Here we go. It's a nose. It's a potato. It's a peanut. It's flip-flops. Is not flip-flops. Not even close to flip-flops, right? Like, so completely not even remotely a drawing of flip-flops. But what's interesting is you get in there and you can see what other people drew. As you know, first of all, you sort of see what the competing things were, flip-flops, potato, and bread. Really confident about the flip-flops. And part of that is you sort of go and you can see what other people have drawn as flip-flops. In other words, what it's doing is not looking for an image of a flip-flop, but our symbol for images of a flip-flop, right? And if you think about what we do for work, we're drawing all the time symbols and shorthand for things. What if we assign meaning to those, right, and start to bring those into an interface? So we're getting more and more sort of classes of products that do this. There's one that's called Wizard, I think. It's UIZERD, so I think like GUI, like UI. Anyway, you decide. UIZERD, Wizard. All right. And it's basically, it's a web app that lets you take, for example, an image like this, so just sort of a very quick sketch of maybe like a little inbox screen, and you go in there and you just sort of, you know, you take a photo of my little inbox screen, chunk, want to use that, I'm going to sort of put it up into their service, and then within 30 seconds they've got it there in their, available in their web app. You just like go over there to the desktop, and you can see what it's done is it's taken this sketch that I made on the left and built a little GUI for it here on the right. And you know, it's made a couple of mistakes. You see it's sort of got two search boxes there instead of one, but it's mapped everything pretty much one-to-one, One of the interesting things, too, is it lets you then grab this stuff in both Sketch or HTML, and you can take a look at it. So if we go over and we look at what the Sketch file looks like, crack it open, and you see that all the different individual elements there are now sort of discrete editable elements. So we've got a little text file here that we can edit. This image thumbnail is something that we can drag around or change. Everything in there, the checkbox, all these are sort of new editable elements. We double-click into one of them, we actually see, oh, these are actually sketch symbols. So we've got now a library of things. And we start to understand, oh, it's used classification to classify my little doodles, my symbols that we're all familiar with in terms of the wireframes that we use, into UI elements. Now, it's kind of brittle, but it's better than sort of stuff that, you know, the old Dreamweaver days, right, where it would sort of build the code from this stuff. The code here is actually not too bad if you sort of look under it. I know there's a little small here, but it's well-structured. It's doing the right thing with checkboxes and labels. It's sort of, it's doing the right stuff. Now, the thing is like, again, it's a little bit brittle. It's sort of, it's still kind of early days here. But the most important thing is that these may not yet be sort of your patterns, your design style, your code conventions. They have style guides where you can edit the colors and typefaces and border radiuses. That's a nice start. But what if the system was tuned specifically to your brand, your site, your code style? What if it knew the way that you sketch the design patterns that you use all the time? What if it knew your design system? It's something that Airbnb has been playing around with. They took a machine learning system to map sketches to patterns in their pattern library so that those sketches could build little prototypes for their screens. When you think about it, that's what design systems are built to do. I work on a lot of design systems for enterprise companies. And the biggest thing that we try to do is just establish a set of standards to be shared among people with a common vocabulary. We're all calling that thing the same thing. And if you've established that, you can share that language with the machines too. Add to it the symbols and notations that you already use. So in that case, you know, if we've already done that, if we're teaching the machines what these interfaces look like, we may not even need sketching interfaces like that. We can just be all, you know, hey Alexa, give me this UI, right? And some of you might be saying, wait a second, that sounds a little bit like my job right now. That's drawing interfaces there. But I would say that that idea of moving from this to dropping in sort of what your design system does, the set of solved problems and solutions that are part of the way that you work, that's not your job. That's the clerical part of your job. That's transcription, right? Sort of dutifully translating a sketch to a comp to markup. And that's not where the real thinking happens, right? Especially if how to do it, of what those components look like, is already solved. That's the whole idea of a design system, to encode solved problems. So in fact, what this then lets us do is sort of say, you know what, let's take that transcription job, let the machines do it, and now we can get on to solving new problems, or figuring out what the right components and solutions are for this. So, you know, I think that the opportunity for this is to identify what are the tedious jobs that we find painful, the jobs that are time-consuming and repetitive and detail-oriented, error-prone, joyless. This is not the stuff that gets you up in the morning, right? Woo! Another joyless day! But it turns out that's the stuff that the machines love. The machines are great at this stuff. The machines do these so we can focus on what we do best. So here's one example. We did some work with a healthcare company. What they were focused on in one of their projects was how to zero in on ways to help radiologists do their job better, the folks who examine x-rays looking for problems. Turns out, though, of course, much of their time is just looking at scan after scan after scan of negative scans, things that where there is no problem, right? Looking for the same telltale signs where there's nothing there at all. You know, so only occasionally do they find a mass and engage their actual skill to determine what that mass is, what kind it is, what it means for the patient. And so what our partner company is able to do is to get camera vision to do a huge amount of triage there to handle that imaging and sort of very coarse detection so that the radiologists could apply their actual expertise. You know, so the machines bring the radiologists the interesting cases. They took over the time-consuming, repetitive, detail-oriented, error-prone, joyless tasks, the clerical bit. Right? So they didn't have to just sort of go through this mountain of stuff. The machines could do that off to the side, and as I said, bring them the interesting problems. So the opportunity here, the way to frame this from a product design perspective, is to say, how can we help people do what they do best by letting the machines do what they do best? And these are almost never the same thing. How can we amplify the stuff that we do best as human beings by supporting our activities in ways that are uniquely possible through machine learning? So, another way to put this is that we have this opportunity to focus attention and judgment, not to replace human judgment, but to focus it. Engage our judgment, focus our attention, show the radiologist where to focus their expertise, or even the person who is filling out that Google Forms survey, here's sort of a smart default for that type of question. We can override that with our own judgment, but it's sort of, here's a way to sort of focus your attention on what matters, and we'll suggest the stuff so that you don't have to worry about that noise. Our industry has spent a lot of time making the machines smarter. Let's instead put a premium on how we might augment human capability. Let's start with that human need and understand how machines can help. So again, it sort of comes to this sort of broad question, and I mentioned those five applications that we talked about before. And those, again, can be small interventions. Sprinkle a little machine learning on it. But I think when you consider some of the pattern matching applications we've looked at, there are sort of these four broad questions that we're able to answer now. I promised you five applications and four questions as we look at what to use machine learning for. I'll turn into that now. The first, maybe the most simplistic, is just let's be smarter. How can we be smarter about the questions that we already ask? So we can use classification or clustering to understand some of those relationships between documents or people or brands. So that Slack example that I gave earlier, how do I just find somebody who's good to understand the hiring process in the organization? That's a search thing, but often we have to do sort of really low-level sort of keyword brute force searching to find, otherwise who had comments that used the word hiring process. And instead, what this is using classification or clustering to say, these are all people who fit into a bucket of talking about hiring process. Now you can search against concept, right? So it's something that makes a question that we already have, how do I find this person, and helps us answer it in a smarter way. I think it gets even more interesting, though, when we start to think about how does it help us to ask entirely new kinds of questions. So instead of doing a search by keyword, we can ask questions based on, for example, emotion. So if you work in a customer care center, at a call center, representatives could queue up emails that have anger or urgency or concern. That's a new kind of search term. It's also sort of a rough Monday morning looking for angry emails. You could also look for happy emails, look for kind words today. But you get the idea, is like now this lets us search for a new kind, we can ask new kinds of questions with this. The third area is that we can also just unlock new sources of data. So all of the messy ways that we communicate as humans through speech or handwriting or those doodles that we were looking at before, video, photos, all that stuff used to be completely opaque to the machines. And now we're able to extract data from them. I think that we've only begun to scratch the surface of saying, what happens when we can use the data that's in all of those sort of, again, previously opaque and messy forms of communication to put those to work. And the last bit I think that's particularly exciting is looking at those clustering opportunities, surfacing invisible patterns and insights and making connections that we'd never seen before. So I think just broadly, as we think about what is designer's role in this, I think a big part of it is sort of saying, how can we apply these questions in interesting ways? Where does this let us take our products in new ways? Because, I think broadly, if you think about what the job of UX and of design is, it's like figuring out what is the problem we're solving? Let's solve that. And so specifically in this world here, our question is, how can we point the AI at the problems that are worth solving? And I would say that often it's those areas, those repetitive, error-prone, joyless tasks, those are often real areas of opportunity that we can cut some of the noise and also begin to introduce some insight. It's important to identify those key places because it takes effort and process change and data gathering to identify those powerful leverage points. And so finding those places where it's like, this is where we can let the machines do what they do best so that humans can get onto what they do best. That's the opportunity. All right, that's sort of my thoughts about how do we think about using machine learning and introducing it into our everyday process. The second part that I want to look at is what's the grain of the technology? And by that, I mean, what are the unique qualities of the design material that give us cues about how we should use it? Or put another way, how do we take that grain and really hit the target for using the technology in ways that it wants to be used? I worked on the phrasing of that for a really long time, so it would make sense for me to draw that arrow, because I did the arrow first, and then, all right, anyway. All right, you guys know what I'm talking about. You put together these things, and it's like, oh. Anyway. So, what does it mean to sort of like work with this, to sort of take the strengths and the weaknesses of it, and to understand how do we work with it to the best possible effect? I'm going to talk about five different aspects of that today, sort of five different characteristics that feel unique about machine learning that require us to treat that design material in a new and different way. And the first one that I'm going to mention is just frankly the fact that the machines are just weird. You know, they study the world, they sift through enormous volumes of evidence and the data, and they come to what can only be described as really surprising conclusions. Not always wrong, sometimes wrong, but often just unexpected, weird. So, an example. It takes a human being, human infant, toddler, about 14,000 brain hours to learn to run. And it turns out that an AI can figure out how to run, and by that I mean sort of manipulate a human model to run, in about less than half as many CPU hours. But the results look like this. So... using those arms for forward momentum, a sort of little consideration of the physics of friction, the realities of rotator cuffs. But then again, if you think about it, we also come up with really strange approaches to locomotion ourselves. So if you just consider the Prancer-size craze of 2013, you know, which is sort of its own sort of unusual forward motion, it's fair to say that when people are so difficult to understand, so unpredictable and eccentric, how can we expect the machines always to make sense of what's happening? So if the machines are weird, it's in part because we're pretty strange ourselves, right? We may never totally understand what we look like to the machines from the other side. We communicate and behave in ways that are not always predictable or that themselves are somewhat fanciful. What do the machines, for example, make of us as creators or artists? This Renoir painting is in the collection of the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia. And the curators there have been really sort of curious and experimenting in terms of how they can bring sort of a machine, how computer vision can apply to their collection and perhaps draw new insights. So when curators ran it through a computer vision algorithm for identification, the robots confidently identified this image as a boy holding a teddy bear. Now you might think, and I would say that it would be pretty reasonable to think that seems like a complete miss. That is a failure. But the curators like loved it when they saw this kind of just sort of surprising result. So, for example, when they asked the neural network to find cherubs in their collection, they found all these things that were definitely not cherubs, but also kind of cherub-like in terms of their form or in terms of their connotation. And so the curators began to find some interesting connections, what I would call some productive friction there. Shelley Bernstein, who led this machine learning effort, she described these connections as magic, and that these unexpected results had generated some new insight, had helped them to sort of think about their collection in new ways, make connections between works and ways to think and talk about them in new ways. So one of the things I think that's worth doing is sort of not dismissing that weirdness right out of hand, but to draw some insight from those unexpected results. Again, consider that a productive friction. The patterns and connections that the machines make sometimes surface themes that might otherwise remain invisible to us. It's the unexpected. I want to talk, too, about unexpected visitors in that case. gentleman named BJ May has a Nest doorbell. You all know what I'm talking about, the little doorbell with the camera, little sort of personal security thing. He had sort of rigged it up, though, so that the door would lock if it didn't immediately recognize him. And so he was there, and it locked on him. And so when he went to sort of see what was going on, what he found was that it had seen a very sort of specific visitor. And said, wait, do you know this person? Because I don't think we should let that guy in. There's an angry, furious man in a bat costume at the door. So the machines perceive and interpret the world very differently than we do. There's this sort of weirdness and unpredictability and often mistakes that are essential to this design material. We're not going to get rid of those. So we have to design to them. And the more that I work with machine-generated results and machine-generated content, and especially machine-generated interactions, where the system itself is in charge of interacting with the customer, sort of almost in an unmediated way, the more I realize that I'm not in control of the experience as a designer. And that's new. We're used to designing a fixed path through information that is under our control, the happy path. And we're used to designing for success. And now we have to anticipate a sort of a fuzzy range of results and confidence. And that's why it's so important to understand, again, the texture, the strengths and weaknesses of your particular model. What is it great at? What is it not so great at? And what is it just flat out terrible at? How do we understand those limitations and constraints and prepare for that? I think this is always our job as designers, is to set appropriate expectations, and interaction design itself is all about guiding behavior. But I think this is a new flavor of that challenge. That how do we set expectations and channel behavior in a way that matches up to the system's ability when we as designers aren't always even able to predict what that system might do? Here's one perspective that I would recommend to do it, a philosophy, perhaps, called BASAP. Friends, the answer, of course, is BASAP, which you might know stands for Be As Smart As A Puppy. This is a phrase from Matt Jones back when he was at the late, great digital agency Berg London, a pioneer in connected devices and digital weirdness. He's now at Google. And he came up with this way to think about creating honest, gentle interfaces for our weird systems. Our goal should be making smart things, he says, that don't try to be too smart and that make endearing failures in their attempts to learn and improve. Like puppies, the way that they learn to walk or to do just about anything. Their confusion is endearing. Their manner is adorable, even when they're wrong or when they even are annoying. So let's be like puppies or robot soccer players, for example. So the right manner here helps us to anticipate, forgive, and recover from error, right? It sometimes is annoying. Even puppies can be annoying. But it won't surprise us or, at worst, endanger us. Too often, though, when machines make a mistake, it simply feels like this. Oh! It's a doll. It's a doll. Just a doll. Crash test dummy. Just a doll. At all. But that's about the design. That's sort of something that did not take into account how do we cushion for mistakes? How do we prevent dangerous results? How do we set appropriate expectations or boundaries for how the device is used, right? So a takeaway that I'd like for you to use here is that because the machines are weird, we need to match the language and manner to their ability. Alexa and Siri and Google Assistant, all of those overpromise right now, right? They front as human-like assistants, and they invite us to ask them anything. And because that sets the expectation that we can ask them anything, they always disappoint, even though they are remarkably capable. These things are fantastic, remarkable pieces of engineering. But their expectation setting is completely out of whack with what their actual capacity is. They'd be better off with a BASAP approach, right? Be as smart as a puppy. And maybe it's sort of a simpler example. PicDeskBot is a bot that basically sends images into the Microsoft image recognition service and then gives you a caption back. And so you can see sort of the results pretty good, right? It's basically saying, here is Microsoft's auto-generated caption, herd of cattle grazing on a lush green field. Not a bad description, right? But it often gets sort of confused, right? It kind of gets charming and weird when it's confused. Part of the confusion here, right, the bad result, is that the confidence with which it gives this clearly wrong answer. There have been studies around image description that show that people are much more likely to, they'd prefer that an answer is vague than wrong in these image-generated descriptions, which is not a bad sort of place to go into in general as we think about handling machine-generated results. How do we present them? So in other words, people would prefer to see something like this than just a wrong result. But I think that we can also start to sort of use, again, that manner and language to start to introduce some things like, oh, maybe a cell phone? Or, I don't know, something like a guitar or a violin or something like that? So we're actually sort of starting to say there's a little bit of a helpful suggestion. It doesn't know the answer, which itself is kind of somewhat endearing. It's like saying, I'm not sure, I'm sort of going in this direction. It also engages human judgment here. It's like, oh, I got to investigate this because the answer is unclear. So I'll talk a little bit about understanding and managing confidence a bit more in a moment. The second thing that I want to talk about in terms of the texture and grain of machine learning is that these things are really narrow domains. They often, you know, are not very expansive. They know they're one area of expertise, of classifications, and then if you ask them to go too far beyond, they get confused. Within that sort of narrow area, they can work what really feels like magic. CycleGAN is a tool, a neural network. It's trained on pictures of horses or fruit, and taught to transform them. So a picture of apples becomes a picture of oranges, or boom, your horse is a zebra. Right? But it also sees horses everywhere. And so sometimes it sort of says, oh, I don't know, everything is a horse. I'll go ahead and change this over. And it's like, wow, Vladimir Putin, how stripey you are. If it only knows horses, everything is a horse. It's a narrow domain. It can solve only narrow problems, and when you go out of that, it gets very quickly confused. So I think just something to remember, and I think that we all know this instinctively, although often I see that when we have teams start to say, how might we engage with this, they expect more of these systems than they can really do. And let's remember that these are narrow. This is not real intelligence. There is no logical inference or deduction. This is pattern matching against a very narrow set of patterns that I've seen before. So it's pattern matching at what I would call a vast but ultimately childlike level. Ben Evans said something similar when he suggested that this is really more like bringing a bunch of interns, or maybe more likely 10-year-olds, to the problem. So as recently as 5 years ago, if you gave machines a bunch of images, the best they could do really is to tell you the dimensions of them. Now we're able to do something where we can sort of have something maybe more like what a 10-year-old could do, to maybe sort them into cats and dogs. A 15-year-old might be able to say, oh, this is kind of cool or uncool. An intern could maybe say, this is interesting. And today, machine learning can maybe match that 10-year-old or perhaps the 15-year-old. But I think this is a thing of sort of saying, what would we do? That's sort of the level that I think is helpful to think about in this narrow domain. So go ahead and think about, how might I solve narrow problems? I think, though, that one of the things is, you know, narrow problems don't have to be small. You know, that you can get a lot of oomph out of just sort of focusing on a big problem in a narrow way. So Deep Patient is a system that analyzes hundreds of thousands of medical records looking for patterns. And among other things, using clustering to identify sort of patients that differ from normal in the same way, they found that they were able to anticipate the onset of schizophrenia surprisingly well, about 2 years before human physicians. So looking at a narrow slice of patients, they were able to address a big problem of diagnosis and then focus doctors' attention and judgment on that area. So that's a problem that's both narrow and big. But the unnerving thing about this, you'd hope that then the system is like, great, we now understand the cause of schizophrenia, but it doesn't give a rationale for the prediction. It just sees a pattern and reports it. Chunk, 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 schizophrenia. Right? So even the project leader doesn't know. So this is a little unsettling with big problems, and particularly on personal problems like healthcare. If we don't understand where information came from, can we actually call it knowledge? These are big questions. But again, it's okay to focus on small questions too, those little cases of UI, those little almost mundane examples. but it always needs to be somewhat focused and narrow. But this example here of deep patient really sort of brings up this other thing, that the logic itself is often opaque, right? So it comes to these results, as we've seen, sometimes weird results, and we don't always understand why. Friends, I feel like we've spent enough time together today that I can share this with you about myself. Anybody here use Spotify's Discover playlists? You know, so it's basically like, here's new music that's just like the music you always listen to, right? So you're gonna like this. When I put mine on, it sounds like this. Do I have any audio? It sounds like this? There it is. Yeah, it sounds like that. So it's like great, sort of a Margaritaville kind of thing. It's like a dad playlist. I'm so uncool, you guys. And the thing is, it's right. I am deeply uncool, and I wish I was cooler. I'm embarrassed by my own playlist. Apparently, I care what the algorithm thinks like. Do you guys ever do this, where you're like, oh, that's my Discover playlist? I better start listening to music more like this to impress Spotify, right? Just trying to understand how the logic works. So somehow I don't like the reflection that I see in Spotify's musical mirror, so I skip the music that I'm afraid Spotify will kind of judge me for. But then I'm also kind of nervous that I'll never hear that song again if I skip it. Like, I'm not quite sure that I should skip it, because, you know, maybe I do actually secretly want to hear this song again. So my mental model of how it works changes how I behave, but I'm also not sure that my mental model is correct. And I kind of wind up paralyzed as a result. So one of the things that we can do, and I think this is true for any application, but it's especially challenging with these systems, is that part of our obligation together is to create data literacy, to help people understand how the internet works now generally, as well as our specific services. What data is being observed? How is it being put to work? And with what result? What's it optimized for? So back to Spotify, this interface should give perhaps explicit feedback to indicate how fast-forwarding a song affects your profile, if at all. I'm just like riffing here. But maybe it should show how the Discover playlist is associated to songs you've listened to recently, or to sort of say, you know, it's been great you've skipped it, but it hasn't been removed from your history yet. Just sort of some sort of hints of how this goes. Again, just riffing here. My point is that because the logic is opaque, we need to signal our intention. When are we capturing information? And to what end? We have to be transparent here. And this is a problem because transparency is not a core value of our industry quite yet. We see that in examples all the time. If you're an Android user and you have Chrome running in the background and you just let it sit, don't even use the phone, Chrome isn't even front and center, it sends Google your location information about every 10 seconds. When you're not even using your phone, just sucking up your location data, unbidden. Facebook gathers your info from your friends' contacts, right? They're building an ad profile of you even if you don't have an account on the network. You know, it's like just by using it, your friends are giving up information about you, often unintentionally, almost always unintentionally. Worse, when you give your phone number for double authentication, for security, to Facebook, Facebook makes that phone number available for ad targeting. So if an advertiser has your phone number as a part of a database, they can target you specifically because you signed up for additional security. That's fucked up. And not at all what I would expect, right? Now, you might say, well, if that's, you know, it's like, well, we don't want to tell people that we're doing that because then they wouldn't use the service. And I guess that may be a good design principle is if you think people won't like it, you probably shouldn't fucking be doing it. Right? Just like, let's use a... But we bend to that request all the time as designers, right? And so how can we start to show that transparency, show the value and the trade-off of what we're doing here and make it clear to people? How do we make transparency a default design principle? I think this is something that we're all interested in as designers, but still sort of lurching toward as an industry. I think part of this, too, is sort of being clear, what is the system optimized for? You know, the system itself should declare what it is optimized to do. So sometimes we can't necessarily judge why it comes to a decision, the opaque logic that I mentioned before. So it's sometimes hard to kind of be clear how it got there, but we can at least be clear about what the system is optimized to do. Be clear with that, not only with our users, but with our own team, with all the people in the organization. What are the results that the system is built to get? What does it consider to be normal? And because that logic is opaque, you just need to then check that the optimization is working. So we just have to constantly be measuring, being clear about what are we trying to optimize for, and is it returning those results. Fix the systems when they don't hit their marks and celebrate and improve them when they do. We might not always understand or ever understand how the systems work, but we can at least understand their results and compare those, so we should do that. Another element that I want to talk to, and this is so important just to understand. I think that we maybe understand it often more, newcomers understand it more maybe intuitively than explicitly, but it's important to be explicit about this. Machine learning sees the world in shades of gray. We tend to think machines see things in ones and zeros, absolute truths. The algorithms see things across a range, right? These are all statistical inferences that they make. And often the algorithms are explicit about the confidence of their predictions. So, for example, there are a whole range of services that you can use from companies like Microsoft to actually start working with machine learning now. And they're great specifically for prototyping new services, trying them out. So I want to show you just an example of using Microsoft's cognitive services as an example of what kind of probabilistic results you get back. So let's just give it a spin. We're going to use its image recognition to do some image captioning. And because I am just this self-involved, we're going to use a picture of me. All right. So let's see what happens when we give it to the system. What we can see is that it does actually pretty well. It sort of gives me a description. It's a man looking at the camera with a confidence of 89%. Right? It's not too bad. I'm not totally sure what they're getting at here, and I think also, come on! Just come on! I'm working on it. But if you look at the percentages here, you sort of start to get a sense of what the actual confidence is. So down below, you can see that person, man, indoor, really high confidence. I'm happy to say it is not at all confident about the older, right? Sort of only 28% confident there. So this is the kind of thing that we can start to say, you know, this should influence our results. We can't just sort of say older man, older elephant man. You know, we have to sort of couch that. How do we sort of start to show what the actual confidence level is? Often, you know, we sort of see results like this where I'm embarrassed to say that Netflix thinks that I'm 72% likely to love Angry Birds. But is that it will look at something like this and be like, let's show the stat, let's show the confidence. And what I see in usability studies all the time is that confidence numbers like this are often not well understood or absorbed. They don't hold much meaning. People gloss over them. So when we sort of think of, go back to sort of our BASAP principles of sort of how can language and manner do a better job to introduce notions of confidence and what it's confident about, we can sort of start to think about what is both the language and body manner, body language almost, of how we can sort of present these kinds of results. Because the stakes are a lot higher than just this kind of image recognition or than a Netflix movie recommendation. We see it sort of showing up in places like law enforcement, starting to see police use face recognition algorithms or pattern matching for predictive policing, sort of pluck suspects out of the wild. And that's serious, right? And sort of are the machines up to it? ACLU last year ran photos of Congress against a data set of 25,000 mugshots, and they proved with science that Congress is a bunch of crooks. They got 28 matches. Incorrectly, of course, 28 matches to people who had been, to other people who had been arrested for crimes. If we look under the hood, ACLU left the setting to the default for this kind of face recognition, which declares a match when there's 80% or better confidence. And Amazon, obviously not very happy with this particular brand of publicity, said, wait a second, we tell police departments to dial that up to at least 95% confidence, which is great. They said, this is a probabilistic tool. This is not just sort of true or false. And in a way, that makes the ACLU's point. The machines require careful tending. So those of us that are close to the machines need to understand how confident and accurate they are, of course, but we also need to understand how can we make that transparent to the people using those systems, the civilians. And not just sort of the confidence in the answer, but almost the system's confidence, right? Reflecting, you know, when it's guessing, how can we show that it's guessing? Or do we even show that guess at all? Does this have real impact? It can have really hurtful impact, too, and things that we need to be really mindful of as we start to cook this into the sort of the most critical parts of our society. You know, I don't know is better than a wrong answer. We were looking at that before in terms of image captioning. And that's especially true when it's possibly a hurtful or hateful or damaging answer, an awful answer. I think I know can be useful, too. Maybe an older man, an older elephant, but not an older elephant. Thank you very much. I think that the opportunity here is to recognize that these systems actually are smart enough to know when they're not smart enough. They are honestly reporting when they're getting a guess. We need to sort of, as designers, faithfully transmit that, both not just sort of explicitly in terms of the stats, but in terms of the language and the manner, as I've mentioned earlier. This is critical. We have to present information as signals, not absolutes. Related to that, and this is the last thing I'll mention in terms of the grain before sort of closing with a few thoughts here, is that the machines reinforce normal. That's what they do. They take all this sort of past data and sort of say, great, I have a good sense of what the baseline normalcy is. And through things like clustering, like I said, it's like, hey, let's find the things that are not normal in different ways. What are the departures from normal? Either to predict the next normal thing or to find outliers, which may be interesting insights or problems in many cases. The question is, you know, what is normal? You know, and sort of, you know, I sort of thought that this was maybe a powerful example of what happens when you put this through Microsoft's face recognition. What is normal is something that we're wrestling with as a society right now in terms of culture for gender and for sexuality. How do the machines keep up with that sort of conversation that we're having as a culture around the world right now? And what if normal is garbage? What if we're sort of the prevailing notion of normal is not particularly helpful or punishes entire groups of people? What if our machines learn from us our own bad or dubious choices? What if they absorb and reinforce existing inequalities or leave out entire categories of people? We saw this just last fall when Amazon discovered that their recruiting tool was showing bias against women, that sort of the people that it was surfacing were disproportionately men. And when they realized it, they were like, wow, we are pulling this. We are going to fix this. But I think that it's important to sort of say this is damaging. As we start to think about codifying the past, this is a phrase from data scientist Kathy O'Neill in her excellent book, Weapons of Math Destruction. You'd think that removing humans from a situation might eliminate racism or stereotypes or any very human bias. But in fact, the risk is that we're going to bake that bias, our past history, into the very operating system itself. And we may not be able to avoid that. But I think one of the things that we can think about as we sort of start to test these systems out is that we can realize that surfacing that bias may actually help us. This is something that, and I don't want to sort of dismiss how hurtful and damaging this bias can be, but if we're listening for it and we understand what kind of society we're optimizing for with our systems, the way that these systems surface bias in ways that are almost naive, matter of fact, sometimes makes obvious what's lurked beneath all the time. And I think that perhaps the Amazon example is one case of that. It's sort of like, they were like, whoa, we are not doing something right in our hiring. We want to fix that. So we may not be able to eliminate bias from our data, but we can certainly surface that bias as a call to action. And also as part of that, think about how might we help our users know when to be critical of the information that comes up. That's certainly something that Facebook has been wrestling with as it's been trying to figure out how to deal with false information and the sharing of it. And it had reasonably good success. In 2017, it rolled out this interface is a way to do it, to sort of flag, hey, wait a second, this thing that you're sharing has been disputed by third-party fact-checkers. And if you try to share it, it sort of says, hey, this is probably wrong. You shouldn't share this. And it had good success there. It saw an 80% reduction of shares and stuff that had been flagged as bad news. But that other 20%, they dug in. Right? Because when something challenges a closely held view, we tend to sort of resist that. And so it helped the 80% mainstream, but it hardened the fringes. And so they went to sort of a new design. This is the updated thing, where you can see that sort of like saying, oh, you know, here's some related articles that happened to be sort of vetted by fact checkers. And then when you go to try to share it, there's, hey, here's some additional reporting on this you might want to check first. It's doing the same job, but in a kinder way, like you would say to a loved one who you want to sort of share some more information with. How can we bring the same kindness and generosity to our interfaces that we would bring to conversations with our loved ones around some of this disputed stuff? And how do we also just sort of help to actually engage their judgment, to help people ask questions of dubious information instead of replacing it? So sort of five areas that I think that sort of like, this is a really unique kind of design material for us to work with. I just want to sort of finish to just sort of say that it's worth always exploring. How will sort of the values and behaviors shift as we use this stuff? How does it change us? Because I think that it's clear that, you know, if we ask of it, what do we want from it, we also need to understand what it requires for us. And that if we don't decide, as the makers of the technology is going to decide for us. I think the last thing that we want is for the future to be self-driving, right? We want to determine where things are going, the kind of world that we all want to live in and that our children want to live in. And it probably doesn't look like this, with chasing a Wi-Fi around our home router, right? But it might look something like this, for example. What if, when you're sick, the machines can handle the diagnosis? Now, if the experience ended there, that would just be abject, right? Even more soulless than our current experience with healthcare. But what if then the doctor came in, and their job is not to do the analysis, the machines have already done that, but to deliver the message in a way that is caring and warm. The doctors will let patients tell their stories. Instead of the 5 minutes that we have with a doctor, the patients will get time to feel heard and ask questions and be reassured. And perhaps that caregiver doesn't need as much education, which makes for cheaper healthcare, and which means we can have more caregivers for more jobs. So better care, lower health costs, more jobs. If we design systems for that, instead of how do we design to remove the judgment and presence of people, that's a different kind of system that we're building. But it's up to us, so that we're not just having humans that work for the machines chasing kettles around networks. Machines can amplify our potential and do the joyless work for us, deliver insight for us. Instead of hijacking our agency, they can augment our judgment so that we can be more creative, more insightful, more compassionate. And that's up to us, the people in this room. We're deciding that. I'm optimistic. This is something that could go sideways in a lot of ways. And I choose to be excited and to lean into the possibilities for this. And I urge you to also, because I think that the tools are here, they're democratized, they're available to you and to your organization right now to put to use in ways large and small. We can build something amazing, so please do that. The last thing that I'll mention, if you're interested in finding out more about this stuff, is I would point you also to mindfultechnology.com, a wonderful resource and movement about how to create interfaces that focus attention instead of distract it. uvetagenda.org, which was part of a group that I was part of, looking at the questions that we need to engage with as designers in designing this stuff. And finally, bigmedium.com, my own site. I help companies figure out how to use emerging technology in new and interesting ways. If I can help you or your team, please let me know. And friends, the last thing that I'll say, one last thing that needs to be said. Thank you.